Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1241, we present three Life Rattle classics written and read by Avaya Barkas. Tonight's program is part two of the Avaya Barkas Travel Story Fest, road trips for those of us unable to take a midwinter vacation. As I mentioned last week, we've not been in touch with Avaya since she left the sunny climes of southern Ontario for Bozeman, Montana. Our author bio for Avaya is rather dry and dated. Avaya Barkas was born in 1974 in Toronto, the elder of two daughters to Greek immigrant parents. She grew up in East York. Barkas went to the University of Toronto and graduated in paleontology in May of 1999. This bio shows so little about Avaya that I was driven to do some internet research to learn more about her and what she's up to these days, and to find a way to make contact. I found such incredibly diverse information that I have to include it here to give you all a bigger picture of the amazing person Avaya Barkas is. First, there are the dinosaurs. The Hilda Mega Bone Bed, Canada's largest bone bed, discovered near the town of Hilda, Alberta, which we'll hear about in Avaya's story tonight. Wikipedia tells us that the Hilda Mega Bone Bed was first described in the scientific literature by David Eberth, Donald Brinkman, and Avaya Barkas in 2010, after more than 10 years of research. The name Avaya Barkas pops up all over the place when you start reading about dinosaur finds in southern Alberta. Then there are the literary finds. Avaya Barkas' story, Blind Spot, won the Malahat Review 2007 Creative Nonfiction Prize, and her story, The Bone, was published in the Antigonish Review, not to mention her article, A Nose for Nuisance, Safeguard Your Trail Hound, that appeared in Outside Bozeman, Southwest Montana's outdoor resource. Did I mention the marathon running? Though my internet research created a brilliant picture of Avaya, so far I haven't found a way to contact her for an update. We will soon, though. In Avaya's stories, landscape often plays the lead. Her wealth of sensual detail places the listener close to the surrounding land and lets us watch the scene for ourselves. The characters she encounters on her travels are so sharply drawn and their dialogue so natural, you almost feel their breath. There are no big events in Barkas' narratives, but she manages to make not much happening both riveting and entertaining, as she captures the open-end feeling of traveling Avaya Barkas style. In tonight's first and second stories, Avaya takes us across the prairies, along with her sister Lena and Andrea, a best friend from high school. Let's listen now as Avaya Barkas reads her story, South of Assiniboia, followed immediately by How to Skin a Quillhawk, tonight on Life Rattle.
South of Assiniboia by Avaya Barkas. I sat in a dim cafe along the bright, cramped concrete of College Street in downtown Toronto. My younger sister, Lena, sat across from me. Outside, cars sped by, and the hot sun glanced off chrome and metal. Lena and I sat at the back of the shop. Spoons clattered, tables shifted, voices chattered, and we talked about our jobs, about our parents, about our dreary, dragging days. Through the dizzying drone and the bustling bodies and the buzz of the city outside, I told my sister I wanted to drive across the prairies. I told her to come with me. Lena stared at the table and traced circles and spilt water with a straw. We left 3 days later in my 86 station wagon with Andrea, my best friend since high school. We drove west along the Trans-Canada Highway into Saskatchewan. Andrea spread the oversized pages of my battered, duct-taped Rand McNally Road Atlas Deluxe Edition across her lap. I settled into my seat. I turned off the paved highway. Dry dust swirled in the still heat, and we bumped down a dirt road south of Highway 13 through Weyburn. Andrea unfurled my roadmap of Saskatchewan. Lena stared out the window from the corner of the back seat. "Do you guys know where you're going?" Lena asked, somewhere south of Assiniboia, when we still had a quarter tank of gas. "Sure," said Andrea. "Of course," said I. We had passed through Assiniboia when the clouds still lagged behind us, an hour north of the Alberta-Montana border, where the wide prairie rolls with low relief. Low grass hills rolled back, rolling in smaller and smaller waves as they approached the horizon, and the road rolled and dipped through the hills. Between the hills, in flat wide fields, gray barns sagged and listed against an invisible wind. We banked around small patches of snow, left over from a late April cold snap, crusting in the gullies beside the road. Clouds coasted through the sky, flat-bottomed prairie clouds, trailing behind us and piling in drifts, and we drove, dazzled, into the sun. Two dusty pickup trucks rattled past us, and the drivers waved. Andrea and I waved back. I turned south onto a net of dirt roads. We stopped near Mayron to photograph the silos next to a little white church with boards over the windows. I did not notice the clouds gathering and darkening across the sky. We passed the white grain pool in Glentworth, stark against the clouds with sun rays filtering behind it, and as we drove through Fir Mountain, past the small cemetery with the homemade headstones, it rained. Andrea shook the road map between her arms and rifled through the road atlas across her lap. On both maps, fingers of local roads branched south off Highway 13 into Grasslands National Park, where we planned to camp. The sky looked full and heavy. Raindrops hit the windshield. "Don't worry, Lena, we're on the right road." Andrea squinted at the map as she turned it around, and the road atlas slid from her lap. "What road are we on?" "Well, we're heading in the right direction." "But how much longer will it be?" "Oh, not long now. How much longer, Vaya?" "Not long now." I peered at my sister in my rearview mirror. "In fact, Lena, we're closer now," I slapped my steering wheel, "than when you asked." "Why, yes, we are," said Andrea. "And we're closer now, and now, and oh, we're closer now." "Closer every second," I chimed. Lena slumped further into her corner of the back seat. "We're on empty, you know." "Oh, we've still got plenty," I said. "Quarter tank." "We had a quarter tank half an hour ago." "So you're right," I patted the dashboard. "Still got plenty." I drove to the end of the dirt road, and we sat in my car, looking at a split-rail fence with the prairie behind it and the sky spread out above. It had been raining a while, and the red needle on the dashboard had been wavering over empty. To our left, muddy puddles swamped over the road where a lone brown Holstein stood in the mud. To our right, the muddy road faded into the rain. The sun sat lower in the sky than when we still had gas. Lena leaned forward with her hands close together on the back of my headrest and spoke in a low voice behind my head. "We're lost." I stared at the wooden signboard hanging, skewed, from a rusty nail in a fence post in front of us. Someone had painted the name of a town on the signboard in yellow, when the wood was still good, with a yellow arrow pointing left toward the cow. We stared at the fence. I could not read the word on the sign. We stared at the grass and at the flat, flat fields. We stared at the sky. "I wonder if that's Montana," Andrea said. Lena slumped back against her seat and pulled her Mexican blanket over her lap. She looked out the window at the road. "Well, are you going to make the cow move?" I switched my wipers to a faster setting and drove past the signboard, accelerating hard through puddles pooled over the dirt so my small tires would not stick in the mud, past the cow, past the fence, and onto another, smaller dirt road where we saw no cows and no fences and no sign of anything. I pulled off the road onto the grass. We pitched our tent. Over the horizon, A thin line of light glowed under a wide gray sky, and the prairie stretched wide all around us until we could see it no more. We stood, three verticals in a world of flat lines. The next morning, I drove, my eyes darting between the red needle on my dash and the mud swamped across the road, until I saw a farmhouse and a barn with a large yard behind it. I pulled up the driveway. A man in a stiff gray ball cap and large glasses hoisted wooden crates off the back of a truck beside a water tower. The man hoisted crates while Andrea, Lena, and I climbed out of my car. Glancing back and forth between each other, we walked toward the man. "How can I help you?" the man asked, stacking crates on the ground beside his truck. I shifted my boots in the dirt. "I was wondering if we could buy some gas." The man looked at me and waited. I bit my bottom lip. "Just enough to get us to a gas station." The man gazed east over his yard. He wiped his hands along his jeans. Nodding, he squinted up at the sky. I thought he might be waiting for something. I glanced at Andrea. Andrea glanced at me, and we shrugged. Lena stood behind us. The man shaded his eyes with his hand and frowned. He looked back at me. "You're from Winnipeg, aren't you?" The man filled our tank. We offered him two $10 bills, but he held up his palm and shook his head. He went back to hoisting crates. I drove out of his yard and back onto the dirt road. I drove west. How to Skin a Quill Hog by Via Barkus. I drive west on a dirt road, past dark rolling hills sweeping up from the prairie and curving against the sky where I thought Saskatchewan stretched, wind-blown and yellow and yawning. The sun cuts down through the windshield and I skirt puddles and dodge ruts while mud sprays my face through my open window. Andrea, my best friend, smiles beside me. Lena, my sister, slouches in the back seat. Grinning, I wipe mud flecks from my cheek and aim my car through snow-capped ridges of lodgepole pine and white spruce, etched and stark against a cloudless sky, with the Saskatchewan-Alberta border stretched between the hills less than 5 kilometers ahead. I press a tape into my tape deck. I made the tape 2 weeks ago, when I graduated from the University of Toronto and fled the city in my 86 station wagon, headed for Alberta. The tape rolls forward and a guitar jangles and Gordon Lightfoot twangs through my speakers. Lena leans her head in her hand. Andrea and I belt out the windows. We barrel toward the border and I cannot feel that I have forgotten to release my parking brake. While the prairie lights are burning bright, the Chinook wind is moving in. Tomorrow night I'll be Alberta bound. I accelerate and gravel whips against the side of my car. I turn up the volume on my tape and sing louder. Lena rolls her eyes and glares out the window. Andrea leans forward from the back seat. She stops singing. "Do you smell something?" I turn down the volume, sniff the air, and pull into the reeds at the side of the road. Lena sets her jaw. She closes her eyes. She opens them slowly and stares through the windshield. "Your front tire is smoking," she says. We climb out of my car and stand by the reeds. Crickets chirp. A creek trickles behind us. Andrea and Lena sit in the grass at the side of the road and unfurl my map of Saskatchewan. Andrea leans over the map. Lena glares at the reeds. I lie on my back beside my front wheel and shove my head under my car. The stench of hot rubber rakes my throat. I cover my mouth with my sleeve, crook my wrist behind my wheel, and jam my fingers into the clump of wet sludge and gravel caked around a small cramped area beneath my tire flap. I feel for the piston that clamps my brake pad against my wheel, but the hot metal scalds me and I jerk my hand away. "I think we should keep going," Andrea says. "The mud will dry up and clump off." She stands and slaps dust from the seat of her shorts with her hands. Fine blonde hairs wisp along her tanned legs, and she pushes one wool sock down with the muddy heel of her hiking boot. She strides over to my car.
"I think we should go back," Lena says.
She rests her chin on her knee and traces a circle in the dirt with a stick. We pack a knapsack and two bottles of water and three apricot granola bars we bought at a bakery in Winnipeg, and hike back along the dirt road to the ranger's station, a small log building tucked between the treed ridges of Cypress Hills Interprovincial Park, where we stopped yesterday to register for a campsite. The station was locked. We saw no one. We peed under a tree across from the paddock beside the log building and pitched our tent in a copse by the creek. In the tent, during the night, Lena woke me, shivering. I helped her feel for her sweatpants in the dark. Careful not to wake Andrea, Lena slid her pants on over her long underwear. She pulled a toque over her ears, and I wrapped my Mexican blanket around her body. Lena tugged the blanket up to her nose. She flopped down beside me, curled her body next to mine, and closed her eyes. I lay back and listened to her fall asleep. Leaving my car at the side of the road, we tramped through the dust to the ranger's station. The sun beats down on our skin and burns our eyes, and we drag our feet 4 kilometers to the split rail fence around the paddock beside the log building. Sweating through our shirts, we lean against the top rail and stare across the grass. A young man works in the stables. He wears a black ball cap and a dark jean jacket, and runs a heavy brush along the back of a sorrel mare. The man watches us approach us as he draws his hands along the back of the horse. The horse gleams. The man turns back to his work. Andrea sets our knapsack in the dirt, pulls out a bottle of water, and gulps. Water dribbles down her chin. I sit on a fence rail and look up at the sky. Lena pushes back her hair and kicks at the dirt. The sun burns down on her copper-streaked highlights, and she wipes sweat from her brow with the back of her arm, then wipes the back of her arm on her pants. She scowls and leans her head to one side.
"I think I have an ear infection."
She wiggles her finger in her ear. I stare at her. She stares at me. Andrea shoves the water bottle back into our knapsack, and we swish through the grass across the paddock where the man brushes his horse.
"Hi," I say to the man.
The man looks up and continues to groom the mare.
"My car's up the road, not far from the border. My parking brake won't release. Is there anyone who might be able to come have a look at it?"
The man slides one hand from the horse's back and slips it down the back pocket of his jeans. He leans his other arm across the horse and gazes down the road where we came from, squinting against the sun. He gazes across the paddock, nodding, and looks around at the stables behind him and at the trees behind the stables. He wipes his palms across his jeans.
"I can look at it," he says.
The man drives us back to my car in his pickup truck. I sit in the cab while Andrea and Lena clamber into the back with an old tire and a bale of hay. I turn and wave at them through the window behind me. Andrea waves back. Lena turns her head. The man plows through mud puddles with one arm crooked out the window, and I watch hills roll past us.
"The park is big," I say.
The man watches the road. He drives over a rut and his head bobs. I look back at the hills.
"Have you got any bears?"
The man peers through the windshield. He frowns.
"Bears?"
He thinks for a moment, then shakes his head.
"We thought we saw some bear tracks on the trail yesterday."
The man drives on. The truck skids through a stretch of swampy water, and the man presses his foot on the gas. He slides one hand lower along the wheel. His other hand taps against his thigh.
"Used to have bears."
He nods. The man pulls his truck up behind my car, where the stench of hot rubber still hangs, heavy in the hot air. The man lies on his back in the dirt with his head beside my wheel.
With one arm over his face and the other pulled up into the sleeve of his jacket, he reaches up behind my tire and pries through the mud. He brings his hand down, stands, and wipes his palms across the back of his jeans. Looking down at my wheel, the man nods.
"Yep," he says. "Brake stuck."
We climb back into the truck, and the man drives us back to the ranger's station. We follow him around to the back of the log building, and he lets us in through the back porch, holding the screen door open. We step through a dim, empty kitchen into a small, bright office where a window faces the dirt road out front. The man sits in a wooden swivel chair behind a wooden desk beside the window. A moose head hangs on the wall behind the desk. Its giant brown muzzle droops over the man's head, and its rack reaches out into the room. Andrea, Lena, and I stand in front of the desk. The man leans back in his chair, clasps his hands over his belt, and looks down at his lap. He presses his thumbs together, touches the visor of his ball cap, and looks up at the wall beside the door, where one wooden chair sits beside a scuffed wooden table. The man stares at the table. He bounces back against his chair.
"That's a big rack of antlers."
I nod my chin at the moose head above the desk. The man turns his head and looks up at the moose.
"Yep."
The man sits back in his chair and swivels from side to side.
"Where can we call a tow truck?" I ask.
The man looks out the window. He wrinkles his nose.
"Can call Elkwater," he says. He scratches the back of his head. "Don't know if Elkwater's got a tow. Can call Medicine Hat."
He pulls the visor of his cap lower on his forehead and hikes it back up again.
"That's a ways, though, about 50 miles. Maple Creek might have a tow. Can call and ask Rick."
The man rummages through the desk for a phone book. Lena and I lean against the wall across from the desk. I glance at Lena. Lena stares at the floor. Andrea unzips her fleece jacket while the man dials the phone.
"Rick! Wayne Boyer."
The man props his boots up on the desk and crosses his feet at the ankles.
"Got 3 girls here."
He scratches his head, winces, and looks out the window.
"Car's stuck in the west block."
Andrea and I peer up at the animal heads nailed to the wall around the top of the room.
"Is that a deer or an elk?" I whisper. "I think there's one of each."
Lena sits cross-legged on the floor in front of the desk. She pulls a bottle of water from our knapsack and rests her head in her hand. Beside her, a stuffed Canada goose looms on a filing cabinet beside a fax machine. A faded poster of Smokey the Bear tacked to the wall beside the goose preaches, "Only you can stop forest fires." Lena picks at her nails. The poster curls and crinkles in the glare from the window. Andrea leans on the wall by the door and browses through pamphlets fanned out over the small wooden table. Andrea studied natural resource management last year at the University of Manitoba. She skims through a pamphlet on local hunting laws. Wayne hangs up the phone.
"You can hunt in the park?" Andrea asks, clutching a pamphlet. "Can hunt in the fall during hunting season. Can't hunt after that."
Wayne rubs the back of his neck.
"Have problems with the Indians, though. They can hunt any time in the West Block."
"Which tribes?" Andrea flips through the pamphlet and steps closer to the desk.
"The Indians?"
Wayne shrugs.
"Don't know. They used to live in the hills here when it snowed. Followed the bison west."
Wayne looks out the window.
"It's all ranch land now."
I sit on the floor beside Lena. I lean back on my hands and stretch my legs out toward Wayne.
"So, have you worked here a long time?"
Wayne nods.
"Every summer, 13 years.
I look out the window. From the floor, I see only blue sky. Andrea replaces the pamphlet on the table. Lena sips water and stares at the floor. I reach into our knapsack and pull out the granola bars. I hold one out to Wayne.
"Would you like a granola bar?"
Wayne looks down at the granola bar in my hand.
Apricot, I say. Wayne hunches up his shoulders. The corners of his lips tug up. Well, okay, he says, and leans forward in his chair. Blushing, he reaches out his hand. An hour later, I sit in the cab of a dirty white tow truck, crammed on the passenger side of the gear shift with Andrea and Lena, beside Rick, the tow truck driver from Maple Creek. I lean against Andrea and press my legs against hers to avoid Rick's fist as he shifts gears. Andrea sits crammed between me and Lena. Her shoulders curve into her chest as she clasps her hands in her lap. Lena presses her body into the passenger side door and hangs her head out the window. The truck rattles and stalls. Rick starts the truck again. A thick crack zigzags across the windshield, and black clouds of exhaust puff up around the truck. The truck lumbers out of the park, up a long, steep hill, dragging my car behind it. Rick gears down. Rick gears down again. The truck eases over the crest at the top of the hill, and we descend a long, winding road of hairpin turns toward the prairie. "Drove off this road one winter," Rick says. "Round the curve up here." He points ahead at the trees sloping down from the side of the road. The truck rattles and picks up speed. "Used to haul logs out of the park. Roads were real icy. Drove a big truck, real loaded down. Tried pulling round the curve, but the wheels wouldn't catch on the ice. Crashed right through the trees." We speed around the curve. I glance down the ravine into thick pines. Lena frowns and glances at me. "Thought I was going to die. The truck kept going and going, and I'm thinking, when's this thing going to hit? Finally stopped at the bottom. I twisted around in my seat, tried moving my arms and legs, and I opened the door and got out." The tow truck winds down the road to the bottom of the hill, and we rattle through rolling grassland. Prairie dogs scamper off the road and dive into burrows. Andrea smiles out the side window as the prairie dogs pop their heads out from holes in the hills to peer at us. I crane my neck, trying to see around the crack in the windshield. The truck chatters and shifts. "Is that the truck squeaking?" I ask. "Prairie dogs," Rick squints. "Ain't quick enough." Lena pulls her head into the cab of the truck. She clasps her hands in her lap and stares through the windshield. "We saw a porcupine in the park yesterday," Andrea says.
"You mean a quillhog?"
"No, a porcupine. He was yellow, like straw."
"That's a quillhog."
Andrea frowns. "I've never heard of a quillhog."
"They're big," Rick says. "Related to the pig. Got an even number of toes on the hoof, like cows. Call that an artiodactyl. Not like horses now. Horses are perissodactyls. Quillhog got a different kind of hoof."
Rick holds his hand out and looks at his fingers. He rests his hand back on the wheel.
"Tastes just like pork."
I shift my legs. My hip aches from craning my body away from the gear shift. Andrea shifts her shoulders.
"It must be hard to skin them," Andrea says.
"Oh no, just flip 'em over, skin 'em up the belly. Comes off easy."
Andrea leans forward. "So you hunt them?"
"Sure, people hunt them. I don't hunt much. I shoot, though, me and my wife. Air rifle and pistol. We're hoping to get to Sydney for the 2000 games. Now I tell you," Rick shakes his head, "you won't ever see better civilian marksmanship."
Hills smooth into flatter grasslands. Hereford cattle graze on slopes beside fences and weathered gray farmhouses. We pass a small shack, set back from the road on the edge of a hill. Rick nods his chin at the shack.
"Good thing you don't know the fellow who lives there."
I glance at Andrea. Andrea shrugs. Lena snorts and shakes her head.
"Why?"
"Well, he's gay, and he peddles drugs."
Rick drives us into Maple Creek, and we leave my car with him at Mainline Auto. We amble through the empty streets. The sun bounces off the concrete. We wander into a small cafe that sells baked goods and local crafts. Rows of glass shelves stretch beside a counter, jumbled with loose beads, colored candles, a tray of silver rings, a rack of clay bead necklaces, and a box of woven change purses. Behind the counter, a girl with cropped bleached hair bustles with a pencil tucked behind her ear. I walk up to the counter and order a coffee and an oatmeal cookie. Andrea orders a hot chocolate. Lena sits at a table at the front of the store and jiggles her finger in her ear. "Where are yous from?" the girl asks. She holds one hand on her hip and pours my coffee into a deep white mug hand-painted with large blue flowers. I wave my hand in the air. "Oh, Ontario. We had some car trouble in the park, though. We just got towed in."
"Who's fixing your car?"
"Rick, over at Mainline."
"I know Rick," the girl smiles.
She sets the carafe back on the hot plate and leans one hand on the counter.
"Funny guy."
"We told him we saw a porcupine. He set us straight, though, told us about quill hogs."
"Quill hogs?"
The girl throws her head back and shrieks. She slaps her hand against her thigh, and the pencil slips from behind her ear.
"Who said that? Rick said that?"
I watch the girl fumble for her pencil.
"He said it tastes like pork. You skin it up the belly."
The girl shrieks again and tucks the pencil back behind her ear. Smiling and shaking her head, she folds a napkin around a large oatmeal raisin cookie and sets it on a white plate on the counter. Andrea watches as the girl froths her milk. Lena shuffles up to the counter and orders a chamomile tea. I wait by the shelves beside the counter and pick up a small blonde wooden box hand-painted by local Mennonites with a house and a bird and a little green hill. I buy the box. Lena buys a woven bracelet. We sit at a small round table by the window at the front of the store, sip from our mugs, then wander back to Mainline Auto. We cross through the bright gravel yard and walk through the dim garage, past my car, before we find Rick lounging in a small room with two other men. They sit in worn brown chairs with their work boots propped on a low table between them, drinking coffee from styrofoam cups. They turn their heads to look at us. The Beatles tinkle from a small radio in the corner.
"Car's ready," Rick says.
I pay cash for the tow, the new front brake holding, and the labor. I wait at the counter as one of the men punches numbers into a calculator and writes up my bill.
"I'm going to wrap duct tape around my parking brake so I remember not to use it," I tell the man.
The man looks up at me. He continues to punch numbers on the calculator.
"The lever inside the car," I say, "not the piston underneath."
The man nods. He hands me my bill. We climb into my car and pull out of the parking lot of Mainline Auto. I shove my tape into my tape deck. Gordon Lightfoot twangs in where he left off. "Oh, the skyline of Toronto is something you'll get onto, but they say you gotta live there for a while."
"How old do you think Wayne was?" I ask Andrea.
"I don't know. Pretty young. He had a wedding ring."
Lena leans forward from the back seat. She rests her head against the side of my headrest.
"We should send Wayne a postcard," she says. I look at the clouds stretched out over the prairie, sleepy and still and billowed like silent puffed sails, and I cannot judge their depth through the sky. I drive north toward the Trans-Canada Highway.
"We should," I say.
That was Via Barkas reading her stories, South of Assiniboia, and How to Skin a Quill Hog. Remember those dinosaurs I mentioned earlier? Tonight's third story, the last of our Via Barkas Travel Story Fest, brings us to the camp near Hilda, Alberta. Let's listen now as Via Barkas reads her story, The Driver's Side Window, tonight on Life Rala.
The Driver's Side Window by Via Barkas. We worked along the South Saskatchewan River, with nothing around us but sun-dried prairie furling out until the sky curved down to meet it. I worked for Dr. David Eberth, a wild-haired, mad-eyed paleontologist who wore a red bandana and Levi's jeans and played guitar in a blues band on Monday nights and weekends. Dave ran a dinosaur excavation program for the Royal Tyrrell Museum of Paleontology. I worked as Dave's thesis student, often the only female in camp, with 4 volunteers. We pitched our tents in a cozy row along the east wall of a Quonset on Stan Krause's ranch. Stan, a retired rancher, allowed us access to his acres of private property along the river where he set his cattle to pasture, 30 kilometers west of the nearest paved road, 30 minutes north of the town of Hilda, along the Alberta-Saskatchewan border. We set up a work tent beside Stan's vegetable garden, and we siphoned water and electricity from his ranch house for our kitchen trailer. We crapped around the west side of Stan's Quonset in a big black outhouse we called the Beef Eater. A guy in a truck emptied the Beef Eater every 10 days, or whenever he remembered. The South Saskatchewan River snaked behind our camp. Every day, we bathed in the river. Across the river, on the west side, CFB Suffield training troops tested ammunition on the prairie. We worked in the Badlands on the east side of the river. We woke and worked and ate and slept, and the sun arced across the sky. Sometimes the sky rumbled and smoke mushroomed along the horizon across the river. We saw black Angus cows. We saw rattlesnakes. We heard coyotes bay and fox cubs yelp as we lay in our tents in the damp darkness before morning. We never saw Stan. We never saw anyone. I had never seen so much sky. Most mornings, we assembled in the kitchen trailer and ate Dave's breakfast burritos. Leftovers of salad, rice, pork chops and burgers, scrambled in an iron skillet on the gas stove with eggs and whole milk, and wrapped in a flour tortilla with grated cheddar, sour cream, and salsa. We gulped coffee and packed our sacks. We bumped across the prairie in the museum field vehicle, along networks of 2-tire ruts, through herds of cattle and baking cow pies. We parked between a gas well and a teepee ring, on a ridge where the prairie fell off into the river valley. Dave roved over ridges and dipped into coulees, his face crisped brown and shiny like chicken skin from the sun. He ranted about rocks and rivers and time. I scrambled after him. With a 1.5-meter Jacob's staff in one hand, a 72-centimeter ice pick in the other, and a yellow field notebook shoved into the back pocket of my field shorts, I clung to Dave's voice. There was nothing else around. Matt Vicarious worked as camp manager. I had worked with Matt the summer before, in Dinosaur Provincial Park, near Brooks, 1.5 hours by paved road, west of Hilda. Every day, Matt wore the same dusty steel-toed boots, the same pair of wool work socks with a red stripe around the top, the same double-ply cotton khaki work shorts, and a bright T-shirt with a picture of a dinosaur or a snake or a lizard or his favorite band, Captain Tractor. This summer, Matt ran an ankylosaur excavation and supervised Dave's volunteers. One morning, Matt fried grilled cheese whiz and tuna sandwiches on Wonder Bread for breakfast. We ate the sandwiches and gulped coffee in the kitchen trailer while the volunteers packed their bags outside. Dave tramped into the trailer and spoke to Matt. "I want you to take the Suburban into town today." "Christ, Dave." "Get the window fixed." The Sunday before, Matt and I had driven the Suburban into Brooks to buy groceries at the Safeway. On our way back to camp along Highway 41 past Hilda, a car whizzed past us on the gravel shoulder and whipped up a shard of rock that shattered the glass in the driver's side window. "And take Via with you." Dave nodded his chin at my kneecap. "Get someone to lance that cutout." "It's not infected." I scowled down at the skin that pulled and swelled around a deep circular gash in my knee. A greasewood bush had gouged me as I hiked down to the quarry. I had stepped past the bush, felt a prick, and looked down to see a branch sticking out of my knee, horizontal to the ground, with my skin folded up around it. "Quit whining." Matt yanked my braid so my head jerked back. "Take a day off."
I don't need a day off. Christ, you two are a pair of lunatics.
Matt contorted his lower jaw and rocked his head from side to side.
I can work longer, Matt mocked. No, I can work longer. What a gong show.
Matt bit into his sandwich.
I'm not going to Medicine Hat by myself. That place is the armpit of the world.
I thought you said Carbon was the armpit of the world.
It is, Smarty Pants. The world has two armpits.
Well, how come they're both in Alberta?
Dave downed his coffee and chucked his plastic mug in the wash basin so it clattered against the cutlery. He hiked his red bandana back over his forehead.
You two don't know the goddamn armpit of the world, he barked.
He wiped the back of his arm across his mouth and stomped out of the trailer. I munched my sandwich and looked at the wash basin. Matt swallowed his bite. He looked at the floor.
What kind of crap sandwich is this anyway? I said. Tastes like shit.
That sandwich is the cat's ass, kiddo. Matt waved his finger in my face. And you'll eat it. I ate your runny pancakes and you'll eat my damn sandwich.
My pancakes were good.
Your pancakes were bird shit. You don't eat vegetables.
I make salads.
Iceberg lettuce is not a vegetable.
Dave stormed past the trailer and yelled in through the open door.
Matthew, stop in Hilda and pick up some pudding.
He stormed past the door and headed for the beefeater.
What does he want? I asked.
Butterscotch pudding.
Can't we get that in the hat?
Dave wants it from Hilda. I'm telling you, the guy's schizo. He needs a woman.
Well, he treats me fine.
That's because you're a woman. Well, that and you're both crazy.
Matt rummaged through the tin garbage can beside the fridge.
Too much sun'll do that. Too much sun and too much work.
What are you doing?
Gotta find an empty pudding container to bring with us to Hilda. If I don't get the right pudding, Dave'll shit on my head.
I leaned back against the kitchen table and swallowed a bite of my sandwich.
I don't need a day off, I said.
I crooked my arm out the passenger side window of the Suburban and breathed in scorched prairie and melting cow pie. Sun gleamed off the hot metal, baking the dust over the museum logo stenciled in white across the side door. Matt squinted and adjusted his glasses. We bumped over the thick bars of the Texas gate set in the road in front of Stan's ranch house, and I told Matt to set the odometer.
Set the odometer?
Yeah, I want to know how far I ran yesterday.
Oh, so you want to know how far you ran?
Matt hit the ball of his palm against a knob on the dash and zeroed the mileage.
Just like you ran up the hill from the river last week.
I did run up the hill from the river last week. That's an 8-minute hill.
My ass, that's an 8-minute hill.
You wouldn't know, you haven't run it.
I'll beat your ass up that hill.
That's what you've been saying.
I closed my eyes and rested the back of my head against the hot vinyl headrest. The wind through the window dried the sweat from my face.
Hey, Matt, why don't you roll down your...
Oh, but look, you don't have a window.
Matt set his jaw and flicked glass shards onto the road from the window frame beside his head.
You think you're so smart, eh? Eh?
He slowed to let a wide-haunched mother cow lumber through the dust along the road in front of us. Her calf stumbled behind her. Matt leaned on the horn.
Come on, out of the way! Christ, the fucking things never go across the road. They have to go straight down the middle.
Matt swerved off the road and sped past the cows, and I waved at them. The mother turned her head and looked at me dumbly from one lazy black shining eye. Matt clicked on the radio and wheeled the knobs around. Static crackled and spat.
Stations are all shit out here, he said.
Texas Gate, I yelled. Hit the odometer. What does it say?
5 kilometers.
Good, that means I ran an easy 10K yesterday.
What's that cut on your hand? I reached for Matt's right hand as he fiddled with the radio. A red gash stretched from his knuckles to his wrist.
All slipped, in the quarry. Hurt like hell.
Yeah, it hurt like hell. Well, I had a branch sticking out of my knee. How do you think that felt?
Christ.
Matt shook his head and gazed out over Stan's pastures through the glassless driver's side window. 45 minutes later, we detoured off Highway 41 into Hilda. We drove through empty streets strewn with litter and rubble and shingles, past row houses leaning against each other, the paint peeling from their sides. We pulled past the iron railway tracks and the abandoned grain pool, past dry gas pumps and the boarded hotel and the fire hall. We stopped in front of the general store. The general store looked like a small barn. We climbed out of the Suburban. "Have you got the pudding container?" I asked. "I've got the pudding container." We walked, squinting against the sun, into the dim store. Near the door, flies buzzed over a large basket of wrinkly apples. Aisles of wide, sparsely stocked shelves stretched to the back of the store where the light faded into shadow. Behind the counter, a large-bellied man in a white T-shirt slouched on a wooden stool. He read the World Weekly News. The headline on the front of the page blared in thick black capital letters, "Alien Head Found in the New Mexico Desert." The man turned a page of the tabloid. Beside him on the counter sat an opened bottle of Coke. Behind him, on a wooden bench, sat the latest edition of Alberta School Bus. Matt strode up and down the aisles, past boxes of cornflakes, loaves of pre-sliced bread, a freezer full of ice cream tubs, a freezer full of pop, and two racks of potato chips. He stopped in front of a section of jumbo marshmallows, chocolate cake mixes, and three different flavors of Crunch and Munch. He slipped into the dimness at the back of the store and emerged again, clutching Dave's pudding container in his hand and muttering as he approached the counter. "Hi," he said. The man behind the counter turned another page of the World Weekly News. A fly buzzed around his head and landed on his ear. The man read his paper. Matt dropped the pudding container onto the counter. "I was wondering if you had any of this pudding." The man finished what he was reading. Inhaling deeply, slowly, he wiped the palm of his hand across the back of his neck. He lifted his eyes. His sweaty jowls hung around his face, and he stared at Matt. Slowly, the man lifted his arm and pointed his index finger toward the aisles behind us. A wet patch of sweat stained the armpit of his T-shirt. "I know," Matt said. "I saw them. There's no butterscotch." The man stared at Matt. The fly landed on his newspaper, twitched, and lit off again. The man stared at Matt some more. "I need butterscotch," Matt said. The man lowered his arm. He resumed his reading. Matt looked at me, then looked back at the man. "Okay," Matt said. He walked back down the aisle, grabbed a 4-pack of chocolate pudding, and lugged it back to the counter. "Dave's gonna shit on my head," Matt said to me. He grabbed a pack of lemon Trident and slapped it on the counter beside the pudding. I looked behind the man at the slivers of wood peeling off the boards of the wall. Rusty nail heads protruded between slivers of paling wood. Against the wall, stacked under the wooden bench, sat piles of dog-eared back editions of Alberta School Bus. Matt paid for his purchases, and we left. In Medicine Hat, we followed other trucks into the downtown strip. We passed the motel with the towering neon sign of the Dancing Cowboy. We passed the hotel with the water slide beside the parking lot. We passed signs directing tourists to the world's largest teepee, and we passed the world's largest teepee. We toured the city until we found our way onto narrower, emptier streets without sidewalks, greasy streets lined with warehouses and factories and auto body shops. Matt pulled into Crystal Auto Glass. He talked to a guy in greasy pants, and I headed for the bathroom, where I looked at my reflection in the mirror. I hadn't seen a mirror in 5 weeks. I hadn't had a day off in 5 weeks. My greasy hair shone, slicked back in a heavy braid. Stray hairs frizzed around my face. My face looked tanned. My legs looked tanned.
My quad muscles bulged and my calves looked rounder. I looked at my reflection. My reflection looked at me.
"How long does it take to replace a fucking window?" Matt whined as we walked out of Crystal Auto Glass. "Guy said 3 hours. What are we supposed to do for 3 fucking hours in this place?"
Matt and I ambled past a donut shop, a shoe repair, a mini-mart, a laundromat, another donut shop, a pool hall, and a pizza joint. We walked into a pet store. Matt classified the fish and lizards. I waved at the puppies through the glass window at the back of the store. I dragged Matt to a 7-Eleven and bought us both jumbo slushies. We wandered through a residential neighborhood, slurping our jumbo slushies through jumbo straws. We wandered past square green lawns and ranch-style houses on quiet streets that all looked the same.
"Did I tell you what happened to us yesterday?"
Matt asked as we turned a corner.
"Natalia and Chris were helping me close up the quarry. We finished jacketing the skull and the scapula and that nice theropod limbo Natalia found. It was windy as hell. We had a bunch of burlap left over, so we made ponchos."
"You made ponchos?"
"Yeah, like that volunteer we had in June from New Mexico. He always wore a poncho. Looked like a potato sack. Christ, that guy was an idiot."
"So you made ponchos?"
"We each made ponchos from the extra burlap and draped them around our shoulders like capes, with our arms through 2 holes in the sides and our head through a hole in the top. I made myself a headband out of the burlap, and Chris drew a skull and crossbones on it with a black marker."
"Oh, Jesus."
"So I tell them to start running the jackets up the hill. And I'm running, with a theropod limb crooked under my arm in a white plaster jacket. I mean, running like a fucking pronghorn. And my poncho's flying in the wind, and I've got my skull and crossbones headband tied around my head. I'm running with my head down, you know, leaping over rocks and shit, and I'm gasping and sweating like a pig, and I get to the top and look up, and there's a guy standing there, scares the shit out of me."
"Who was it?"
"Guess."
I stop walking.
"Stan."
"Nope.
Stan's dad."
"Stan's dad?"
"Yep." Matt nodded and kept walking. "The guy's ancient. Stood there in his big white cowboy hat and cowboy boots with his thumbs stuck in his jeans pockets and the whole goddamn prairie behind him."
"What'd he say?"
"Nothing. He nodded and tipped his hat. I could see Chris and Natalia scurrying around down by the quarry in their ponchos. So I put the jacket in the truck, and I ran like hell back down the hill." At Crystal Auto Glass, Matt got the keys to the Suburban from the guy with the greasy pants. I climbed into the passenger seat.
"Wow, my window's really clean," I said.
I streaked my finger across the clear surface of my passenger side window. "Did they wash the truck?"
"Wait a minute."
Matt frowned at the window frame on the driver's door.
"What?"
"There's no glass in here."
"What do you mean there's no glass in there?"
Matt turned and walked out into the store. I stared after him through the window frame on the driver's side door and watched him talking to the guy in the greasy pants. Matt walked back to the Suburban with his hands in his pockets and his mouth pulled into a line over his chin.
"What's going on?" I asked.
"Christ, what a gong show! They replaced the passenger side window."
"But it already had a window."
"I know. They replaced it."
"But the driver's side didn't have a window."
Matt stared in at me through the glassless window frame. "They thought it was rolled down."
"You're joking."
"Nah." I stared at the dust filmed across the front windshield.
"So what do we do now?"
Matt held his hand up beside his head and dangled a set of keys from his index finger.
"They're giving us the Crystal Auto Glass truck. The Chickmobile."
He bounded toward the parking lot outside the garage.
"Come on, let's cruise."
Matt and I cruised in the dusty white pickup truck with Crystal Auto Glass stenciled in red across the hot side doors, up and down the sweaty streets of Medicine Hat. Matt clicked on the radio and we blasted 98.8 FM, hits of the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Neil Young came on, and Matt cranked up the volume. "Keep on rockin' in the free world." I rolled down my window.
That was Vaya Berkus reading her story, The Driver's Side Window. This concludes Life Rattle number 1241. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded Vaya reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Thursday evening to hear stories from new writer Sammy Karaman.